According to Milton Friedman, the late conservative economist, and this was a quote used so meaningfully by Naomi Klein in her book, The Shock Doctrine, I quote, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." And Friedman wrote that in 82, and boy, did the right seize every crisis from that period up until the current one to put their ideas in place. Now, according to today's first guest, David Corton, I'm going to quote him now. This is quoting David Corton. "The financial crisis has put to rest the myths that our economic institutions are sound and that markets work best when deregulated. Our economic institutions have failed, not only financially, but also socially and environmentally. This, combined with the election of a new president with a mandate for change, creates an opportune moment to rethink and redesign." Still quoting Corton, "President Obama has promised to grow the economy from the bottom up. That would be a substantial improvement over growing the top at the expense of the bottom. The real need, however, is a bottom-up transformation of our economic values and institutions to align with the imperatives and opportunities of the 21st century. It involves a five-part agenda: clean up Wall Street, play by market rules," and by that he means the real market rules, "self-finance the real economy, measure what we really want, and convert to a debt-free money." Our second guest today, Randy Hayes, has been highly successful waging corporate accountability campaigns with Rainforest Action Network and International Forum on Globalization, and he's now working to launch a media campaign to ecologize the economy. So Corton's got some big ideas. Hayes has some of his own and a knack for activism, and I'm going to talk with both about taking advantage of the current crises to transform our economy and, in turn, our future reality. David Corton has written some wonderful books. He's the author of When Corporations Rule the World, which was a book that came out in 95, 4 years before the uprising in Seattle against the WTO and globalization, and I think was something that had been read by a lot of folks that were there. Another book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. He's co-founder and board chair of Yes Magazine, a magazine of positive futures that I highly recommend. And he's a board member of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, BALLE. Welcome again, David Corton.
Terrence, it's always wonderful to be on your show.
And I can't help but remember you were one of my very first guests in 1996. When the show aired at 10 p.m. Thursday nights, you happened to be in New York that night, and you did the show from 1 a.m. to 2 a.m.
You've got a good memory. I certainly remember that, too. That was that was wonderful fun, and I'm really proud to have been part of your launch.
Very good. And yours. I believe that was one of the first interviews you did on that When Corporations Rule the World.
Well, I think that's true, and also When Corporations Rule the World was it was the first book that I wrote for a more general audience. And so, it was an interesting time for both of us.
Yep. I like listeners, as you know, to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So you served in the military. You worked in aid and development around the world. You were hardly a radical reformer. What did you learn in those years that informs your current work?
Well, I did, Well, of course, the military was fulfilling an ROTC obligation to keep myself out of the out of field duty in the Vietnam War. But the my work in development started out with it was actually a very conservative motive. But I started out as in college as a very active young Republican, very conservative, and I learned about these communist revolutions that were born of the frustrations of poverty, and decided to devote my life to bringing the secrets of U.S. business success to the rest of the world. And what happened over time was I realized that the economic models we were bringing out were actually increasing desperation for a lot of people, were destroying the environment, making a few people very rich, but also tearing apart the social fabric of communities. And so, over time, I devoted more and more of my attention to trying to understand where that model went wrong and what we needed to do to actually create a world that would, in fact, work for everyone.
Okay. And we've, as you heard me in the intro, quoting Milton Friedman about when a crisis happens, it depends. You know, you want to put in place the ideas you got lying around, and then your introduction to your own book mentions that, you know, this is an opportune crisis. Why did you write this book, and how quickly did you write it?
Well, it was quite a phenomenon. It was very much a creature of the financial crash. I got a call. I was writing some articles for Yes Magazine and Cocoon on the financial crash and the need to use this as an opportunity to do some basic rethinking of the economy. And my publisher called me on November 24th last year and said, you know, these articles would make a great book. And at that time, I was scheduled to speak at a major national conference at the Trinity Wall Street Church, which is the historic church that sits right at the foot of Wall Street that you see in all the Wall Street pictures. And I thought, my goodness, what an amazing opportunity to stand up in the pulpit of that church and call for bringing down Wall Street. So that provided an incentive, working with my publisher, to get this book out in 2 months. I look back, I still can't believe that it came together the way it did. But it was a product of having a very clear bottom line message that, you know, our economy is not just broken. It is a failed economic model that is designed to meet the purposes of a totally corrupt set of Wall Street institutions, and that this is our opportunity to open a national conversation and fundamentally rethink what is the purpose of the economy, and what do we have to do to design an economy that actually works.
I think I mentioned to you in an email that I wanted to do something that I do now and then when the subject warrants it, and that is what I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It. And it's basically three questions. How is it broken? How did it get broken? And how do we fix it? And in this case, how is the current economic model, the economic system in the U.S. broken, or as you say, worse than broken? And briefly, just some evidence of that. And obviously, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. People got a sense, I think, that things are bad.
Yeah, well, you know, in a way, the question of how is it broken? I would say it's not broken. We start with the question of what do we believe is the purpose of an economic system? And the system we had before the crash was a system that was designed and managed primarily to make huge fortunes for Wall Street money managers. That even moved beyond the idea that the purpose of these institutions is to serve their shareholders. You know, it was about generating bonuses, getting your money out as quickly as you could, and you know, the devil take the hindmost. That system got broken, but that's not the system that we want to fix. We need to get down to the question, well, if that's not the purpose of the economy to make a few people very rich, what is the purpose? And I would say it is to meet the needs of people and communities and families on a long-term ongoing basis. And so what we have is a system that, you know, not only crashed and failed in its own terms, but a system that is, in fact, has been destroying the environment, increasing inequality, destroying the productive capacity of the United States as a nation by outsourcing jobs. So it is, you know, it's a disaster on every dimension. And the positive side of the financial crash is that it has kind of opened up the illusion, broken through the illusion, so that ordinary people everywhere can see the extent of the corruption of that Wall Street system, which literally, you know, gets its power from the fact that this is a group of institutions that have established a monopoly over the creation and allocation of money. And in a society in which everything we do depends on money, that is the absolute control. And they've been using that power solely to enrich themselves.
Okay, let's talk about a couple things briefly just to sort of flesh this out. One is that when you make the point that when you wrote When Corporations Rule the World, you were talking about multinational corporations owing nothing to any nation.
I want to stop you there for a minute, Terrence, and correct your language.
Those,
the term multinational corporation is a PR term that is supposed to lead us to believe that these corporations are national and rooted everywhere. In fact, they are transnational or global. And as you're about to say, they're not connected to, they do not acknowledge any loyalty or allegiance
right.
to any place or people. So, you know, one of the things we all need to do is correct our language so that we're calling it what it is.
But what I was going to say was that you, in the new book say, well, you know what? The corporations don't actually rule the world. That is, the corporations that make things. But in fact, they are owned, operated by Wall Street. Speak to that just for a second.
Of that Wall Street power, absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, that gets us down to the fact that, you know, if a corporation is traded through the share markets or owned by one of these Wall Street private equity firms, it is in the business of making rich people, well, making money for already rich people. That's the business. And if it's producing any goods or services that may be useful, that's pretty much incidental.
Exactly. And some will say that because shares are spread among pension firms, so that means a lot of people have a little piece of this market that, in fact, you know, the shareholders represent everyone. Your answer to that?
Well, that the ownership is actually very highly concentrated, and the percentage that goes to working people and pension funds is a fairly limited piece of the total. Now, of course, it also gets much more complex when you get beyond just the share markets to all of the investment funds. And, you know, one of the anomalies of these scams that they were running is they were, you know, creating all these fictitious assets and overrated bonds and derivatives and various kinds of securities, which at the top of the pile they'd sell them off to pension funds as safe investments, when in fact that most of them were potentially near worthless because they were built on mortgages that there were toxic mortgages that were very unlikely to be repaid. We still got all the issues of credit card debt and so forth. Now, where this really gets tricky is that the total amount of financial assets that get created out of all these games that Wall Street plays exceeds by a substantial margin the total value of all assets in the world. Or, some calculations indicated that the value of financial assets on Wall Street before the crash were several times greater than our annual GDP.
Now, and not just ours, but the world's.
The world, yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You've got this crazy thing where those of us who do have have a stake in these assets, which gives us a political stake, and this Wall Street's a great thing. It's making money for us hand over fist. We don't do anything. But it's really creating a phantom wealth, fictitious wealth, that there's nothing to back it up, which means that that those of us who thought we had great assets in the financial markets have expectations, including in our retirement, that could never be fulfilled because there's simply not enough wealth in the entire world, the real wealth, to back it up.
Now, your background was in economics, correct?
Well, it was a business school.
Actually,
people often refer to me as an economist, but basically my field of expertise is organizational design.
So okay.
I look at economies as behavioral systems, not just pricing systems. That's why I come out with a different set of answers often than economists do.
And let's go in just a little bit more into this distinction, which is key to your book. It's in the subtitle, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. And so go a little bit into this distinction between phantom wealth and real wealth, and between Wall Street and Main Street.
Yeah, well, one of the ways that we got sucked into, you know, as the general public got sucked into, you know, accepting these Wall Street games, is the illusion that money is wealth, and we're conditioned to believe that money is wealth. It's so interesting in, you know, looking back on my business education that all the terms that we were educated in, wealth, assets, capital, resources, none of those terms make any distinction between money and things of real value. Now, the key there is that money is simply a number. You know, it's an accounting chit that we accept because it gives us a claim to things of real value. Now, you start with that illusion that money, just a number, is wealth, and then you easily slip into the illusion that people who are making money are creating wealth. Now, in fact, what Wall Street's been doing is pumping up financial bubbles, engaging in usury, creating fictitious assets that become the basis for more lending, and on, all these games that are creating these fictitious financial assets. Now, that's phantom wealth. And part of straightening this thing out is recognizing that, you know, real wealth consists of things that have real value at a basic level. That would be our land, our labor, our technology, information, and so forth. At the deepest level, real wealth consists of, it's living wealth. It's happy, healthy children. It's strong families. It's a strong, caring community. It's a healthy, natural environment. Love, peace, all the things that are, in fact, beyond price, are those things which are ultimately most valuable, but they have absolutely no place in the Wall Street financial statements.
Yeah, let me just mention a couple of things in terms of that. You know, environmentalists or people who look at this, not just environmentalists, people who look at the big picture will often have realized that it isn't even often the products that we want, it's what the products bring us. In other words, one of the distinctions they make is that Ray Anderson of Interface Flooring, you know, it's not that we need a particular carpet or something. What we want is warmth and comfort. It's not that, and so that's one distinction that I think takes what you're saying down even in one more level, right? In other
exactly.
words, what we really want are, as you said, health, relationships, community. Those are the things that matter. And so that's one of the things that is a way of looking at this. And I find an awful lot of what we're talking about here is looking beneath the common accepted realities.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, if you take that seriously, then you step back and you say, well, how would it be different if we designed and managed our economy actually to produce the things that we really want?
Yeah.
And not strong, and those secure families,
right.
and happy children, et cetera,
exactly.
and love and peace and so on. And, you know, needless to say, that would be an economy that looks rather different than the one we have now.
So let's move to that second big question, David Corton. How did our economic system get so broken or so distorted? And our system's never been perfect, but it appears to many that it was far better, let's say, from World War II until the Reagan Revolution. That was the time while we had problems in civil rights and women's rights and gay rights and so on, it was the era of the American middle class. So briefly, what is the history and what are the causes and who are the culprits of the situation we find ourselves in now? Again, briefly.
Yeah, very you're right on there. Well, it starts with recognizing that our country was founded originally more as a plutocracy than a democracy, ruled by rich people. And we had generally quite significant inequality, even, you know, running into slavery at the bottom during the early history of the country. Now, you know, many of us who grew up after World War II had the impression, you know, had the sense that the middle class defined the American reality, that this was what America was about. We overlooked the fact that that was a fairly new phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
as a result of very clear government policies to increase equity. And it also, you know, for a time, it was supported, I think, by a broader social contract that all the elements of society tended to buy into, that, you know, an equitable distribution of wealth and meeting needs of people and strong social programs and so forth. But then the the folks that had at one point enjoyed extreme economic power and those that aspired to it began to think that maybe it was time to for the elites to get back control. And of course, that's where Milton Friedman comes in and his philosophy of unregulated markets and freedom for the richest and most powerful. And you know, the far right organized to restructure society to reestablish elite control, and so they, you know, they did it by changing rules that that allowed for the extreme concentration of corporate power, and you know, built it on an underlying ideology that says this is the only way to organize society, that we are you know, humans, we are naturally greedy and individualistic, and this is the way to channel this into productive outcomes for society. So, you know, this whole thing around the world with the help of the IMF and the World Bank and then the World Trade Organization, all about changing the rules to take away the constraints on the ultimate concentration of corporate power and control of the money system.
And then the other thing that that you talk about, and you do quote Kevin Phillips from Bad Money, that what happened was that people didn't notice. I think people sort of, some people saw that going on, but they thought as long as they were in on the bubbles, it wasn't so bad and so on. But it was this huge shift in American, what American produced from goods. What they talked about was from goods to services, but it wasn't really just that. It was really this enormous concentration in the financial sector.
Yeah, well, this is the extraordinary thing that we somehow, you know, the people responsible for economic policy became convinced that that we'd be much wealthier as a nation if we just focused essentially on creating money instead of producing real goods. So, you know, manufacturing fell from you know, nearly 30% of GDP in 1950 down to 12%
right.
In 2005, while financial services went from 11% to 20% of the economy.
Yeah, and I think most people really did miss that one, that suddenly one out of every $5 was in financial services. And as I've pointed out before, the best college graduates more and more were going into banking, not into medicine, not even into law, certainly not into, you know, other more productive things, but just that the best and the brightest, in quotes, were going into finances. Third question, how, and this is the one I want to concentrate on, how do we fix things? What are the solutions?
Yeah, well, the first thing is to be clear that fixing the existing Wall Street system is not the solution that we want. And this is where, you know, I have a lot of trouble with President Obama's current policies, because it's in dealing with Wall Street, the thrust seems to be to get the thing going again as it once was.
And even it seems to me that since that system over the last at least 10 years has been based on a sequence of bubbles, that it almost seems like the only way that systems work is if you rev up another bubble, which is the last thing we need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we need to, you know, not fix the system, but we need to replace it.
And so
replace it with a system that is really devoted to producing real goods and services, real wealth, to meet the needs of real people and real communities and heal our natural environment.
And that's where you spoke of this, as we've talked about the phantom wealth, real wealth. Talk about the Wall Street versus Main Street.
Yeah, you know, these are sort of, you know, large labels, but they've come into fairly common use. So Wall Street refers to the institutions that are devoted to creating phantom wealth. They're the big corporations, the big banks, that are destroying the real wealth of the planet and sucking up control of what remains into the hands of the Wall Street money managers.
But what is Main Street?
Main Street is the economy of local businesses, of people, of working people, who are producing real goods and services in response to community needs, providing jobs that provide people with a source of livelihood that tend to be much more stable as long as the businesses are able to to stay in business, and they operate within a framework of community values. Now, and you know, one of the things we're trying to do through groups like the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies is to build that sense of vision, purpose, and identity in local businesses. That you know, their whole purpose, their whole nature is values based, and a very different purpose to rebuild local food systems, local financial systems, become self-reliant in energy, and all the things that contribute to long-term community and environmental viability and health. So that we refer to as Main Street. So they're kind of convenient labels that are out there in the public discussion to distinguish between the predatory economy of Wall Street and the productive real wealth economy of Main Street.
Well, the big sense that I must say, there's a voice on one of my shoulders that keeps whispering in my ear as I'm reading the book, and as I read some similar, the work of Bill McKibben, for instance, and so on, is this voice that says, but wait a minute, that's the past. These local economies, that's gone. It's gone forever. They've gone out of existence. They've gone out of business. You can't go back home again. What do you say to that?
Well, the system that we thought was the new system has crashed around us. And in fact, the communities that have got the best prospects for the future are the ones that are picking themselves up and working very actively to rebuild their local economies. And that is that's happening at with incredible acceleration all around the country and, in fact, around the world. Of course, Bill McKibben tells those stories beautifully in his book Deep Economy.
Right. And one of the other things is I saw an article, I believe, in the LA Times or somewhere else just today, yesterday, that community banks are doing fine. Community banks who actually operate as banks used to, that is, they loan money to local folks for houses and business that are local, they keep a relationship with them, and so they're doing fine. They didn't get mixed up in what the investment banks were doing. I wanted you to talk about your 12-point new economy agenda. Maybe not all 12 points, but something so people can have a sense there's a reality here, that it's not just a utopian ideal.
Well, there's a whole series of changes, and one, of course, is that we need to fundamentally rethink our money system. You were talking about the small local banks. The issue of Yes Magazine that's just coming out is on the new economy, and it's got a lot of discussion of the changes we need to make in the financial system and how people are rebuilding their local banks and credit unions and how that works and all kinds of new forms of investment to support the rebuilding of the local Main Street economies. So that's a piece of it. Another piece of the financial thing is the whole way we create money. You know, most people don't realize we've got a money system in which our money is created by private banks when they issue a loan.
Now, let me speak to that, because it seems to me many people think that the problem is the Federal Reserve, which is, as we know, it's only a quasi-governmental institution. It's actually in private hands, and people think that's the boogeyman. But you say that actually it isn't just the Federal Reserve that creates money. Money is created when banks make loans.
Yeah, and your point's very true that the Federal Reserve, it's very ambiguous how the ownership is. You can argue that either way, but the reality is it is basically controlled by the private banks and is managed to serve their interests. That whole system is the system by which our money is created. So every dollar in circulation, somebody's paying interest on that to a private bank, which is one of the reasons the banks are such profitable businesses. Now, the whole complex system. When you take a loan, the bank creates the principal. It does not create the interest on the loan, which you have to find from someplace else in order to repay your loan, which creates an enormous pressure to keep growing the economy. It also results in a grow the economy to generate demand for new loans to cover interest, but it also results in a very powerful dynamic of wealth concentration, because obviously people who are able to create a product money out of nothing and then achieve a guaranteed return on it or in a very very profitable and powerful business.
And your suggestion is that the federal government get in the business of creating money, but
yes.
The point you make is that where banks create money as loans, the government would create money to produce things. In other words, the stimulus package would be an example of what you're suggesting?
Yeah, exactly. Now, obviously, you know, one has to manage the money supply so there's not, you know, the amount of money does not exceed the useful productive capacity, because that leads to inflation. But in terms of putting money into circulation and managing the money supply, when new money is needed, it makes a whole lot more sense for government to spend it into existence on things like public infrastructure, education, all the things that we need to have a functioning society, rather than turning to the banks to borrow it from banks that spend it, that loan it into existence and then charge us interest.
Now, one of the problems that as I said, that little voice behind me that says, you know, wait, this can never happen, you know, think that we've gone past that and so on, is that, and when I was asking, how did we get where we are now, so much of it is that the people who have access to the money in a system where money, where we do not have public financing of elections, and so money then is the determining factor in elections, means that basically the big money, Wall Street, the big banks, the big insurance companies, own so many of our public servants. And so then the system begins to deregulate itself, et cetera, and we end up where we are today. You're talking about such a radical change. How do you think that can be possible? And after I hear your answer, I bring Randy Hayes into the conversation.
Yeah, well, the only way we're going to get there is through public education and public mobilization. You know, and it starts with helping people understand that there is there are other models, there are other ways to organize the economy. And, you know, in terms of other steps we need to take, to me, one of the most important is changing the indicators by which we evaluate economic performance. Moving away from financial indicators like GDP and putting in place instead indicators that track the health of our society, of our children, our communities, and natural systems.
If I go back to the time when I had you on in 96, I think that's probably about the time I started talking to the folks at Redefining Progress and Hazel Henderson and so on. This idea of finding a more true way to measure our wealth and measure our social health have been around for a long time, making very little headway.
Yeah, well, you know, ideas take time to germinate and find their place. And as long as it looked to most people like the economy was working, you know, there's not a place for those new ideas. But you, of course, started out with that quote from Milton Friedman, yep, that you got to get those ideas.
Okay, so in other words, what you're saying, one of your frequent answers will be that we've seen the Wizard of Oz. We've seen behind the curtain now, even as a society, not just a few pointy-headed, you know,
yeah,
academics, but people have seen it, and so now is that moment. Let me bring in Randy Hayes. Randy Hayes is a climate policy officer at the World Future Council, and he is also the founder of Rainforest Action Network, and he's a veteran of many high-visibility corporate accountability campaigns. He also served as president of the City of San Francisco Commission on the Environment and as director of sustainability in the office of Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown. What I like about that is he's worked on a city level, which is where things actually happen, and he's worked in corporate accountability campaigns. Randy Hayes, welcome again to KPFK and Free Forum.
Yeah, Terry, good to be with you and with David as well.
Yeah, I know you guys.
We've worked together a long time.
Exactly, on the
International Forum on Globalization.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Now, Randy, just to bring you into this conversation, you've been listening for the last few minutes. When you've been on the show before, it was usually having something to do with Rainforest Action Network. What are you up to now?
Well, heroic is all of our campaigns on corporate accountability were. They didn't change the system, which was David's main point. We've got to replace the system. And, you know, it's brush fire fighting and damage control. There are ways in which you can fight the brush fires and promote systemic change, and we need to get more clever at that. So I stepped down from running Rainforest Action Network to have the time to read books like David Wright's and others and think out the economic issue in particular, because I learned from David Brower that the most important environmental policy is economic policy. That may simply be true for virtually everything you might care about. The most important human rights policy is economic policy. If we don't get our economic policy right, we're not going to save the day.
And I would say, as I sort of referred to before, that the most important political policy is how we fund elections, which again is the economics of politics. Agreed?
Completely agreed.
Okay. So you recently sent me a working paper, True Cost Economics, a Campaign to Ecologize the Economy, Ensure Fair Play and Long-Term Survival. And when I saw that in the same week I was going to have David on, that's when I decided that I would bring you both together. I see a lot of similarities in the thinking. Briefly, who are you working with and what are you proposing?
Well, I work with people like David Corton and many others, but I recently read Agenda for a New Economy, and it's a fundamentally important book that we all can learn from. What I think I bring to the equation is campaigning prowess. Instead of campaigning to get the World Bank and to stop funding hydroelectric dams in the Amazon or to get Burger King to quit buying rainforest beef from Central America, if you think about it, the concepts that Hazel Henderson and others that you talked about, indicators like Redefining Progress came up with, the Genuine Progress Indicator, they have been around for a long time, but they haven't caught on. In part, that's because of what David said, that, the time wasn't right. But the other side of that equation is that the environmental groups don't really change or campaign to change the rules of the economy. Right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And there's never been such a campaign. We need a massive campaign to ecologize the economy the way that David spells out in his book. And so what I want to do through the World Future Council and other organizations is launch a national media campaign to popularize the need for a systemic shift in the economy from basically cheater economics to a true cost economy.
Okay, let me ask you to define a couple of terms there. When you say ecologize the economy, that could go over some folks' heads. What do you mean by that?
Well, primarily two things. Two things that I focus on around the economy is that it doesn't have anything that links it to the hip around carrying capacity issues. Carrying capacity issues are the life support systems for planet Earth, the breathable air, the clean water we drink, the fertile soils that grow our food. The biosphere, the planet as a whole living unit, has life support systems, and we need to stay below the carrying capacity. We can't surpass the carrying capacity, and the economy cannot be allowed to surpass the carrying capacity. So we've got to come up with new institutions that help us understand that and link the economy to that, so that overproduction that destroys the life support systems is just simply not allowable. That's one major arena, the carrying capacity. The second one is just simply to internalize externalities, pollution externalities.
Okay, let me for listeners to whom that one's a new idea, externalities is when the and David makes a good point of this. In David Corton's book, Agenda for a New Economy, he goes back to Adam Smith, and he says, that the free market fundamentalists constantly say that they are following Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, and he points out that they are not. That what Adam Smith, his idea of a market that would work, had a number of limitations on it. And it's when you drop those limitations, they get into the madness that we've gotten into. So when you say externalities, one of the notions is that the cost of a product should be included in the price of the product. And that would be a market that works. What's happened is the pollution costs of oil, as a very simple example, are not in the price of oil.
The simplest example I like to use is a coal-fired power plant. The particulate in the air from the smokestacks that gives little children asthma and the mother has to rush them to the hospital, the coal company is not paying that hospital bill. The mother is, the family is, the parents are, right? And so we've got to grapple with that situation in a systematic way, and we need institutions that do that in our domestic economy, and also for anything that we import.
Okay, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. My two guests today are David Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, and Randy Hayes, a longtime activist and who is proposing now a campaign to really take on the economic system. Let me bring David in for just a moment. Any thoughts on what I've been saying with Randy?
Well, I think Randy's nailed it absolutely here in terms of the work that we need to do with the environmental groups, but it's also with all the other range of progressive groups. That on the progressive side, we have spent so much of our energy on individual campaigns, like the individual corporate campaigns that Randy talks about, and missed the fact that actually the far right has been focused for decades on changing the rules to change the system in ways that actually have created all the individual issues that that many of our progressive groups campaign against. And,
right.
And we need to come together and build this larger agenda together. And if we do, around changing the system. And if we do join forces on that, we can make it happen, particularly with an administration that's going to be far more receptive now than any administration we've had for decades.
So let me say a couple of things to that. One is that a point that I've made since before the election, and actually going back to the Clinton administration, is that, and people who've heard me say this before are going to be bored by it, but that FDR ran on a moderate platform. What brought us the New Deal was the people held his feet to the fire, and he even said to them, "You have to. I can only be as bold as you make me," and the unions, the farmers, the people did that. And unless we do that with Obama, we will get not the president beholden to the small contributors who gave him a great deal of his election money, but the large contributors who also don't lose sight of the fact gave him a great deal of his campaign money. And that is perhaps why we see, or I would say that is without a question why we see, Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner and basically Goldman Sachs alumni running our economic policy. Now, let me also mention to both of you and to listeners that you are both proposing radical change. And so I looked up radical, and there are two meanings of radical that I think both fit. One is, and this is the original meaning, of relating to or proceeding from a root. That when you are dealing with root causes, that's radical. The other is marked by a considerable departure from the usual or traditional. That's the meaning most people think radical means. As I read both of your stuff, again, that little voice reminds me how tough it is to get folks to deal with root causes rather than symptoms, and to even entertain radical breaks with business as usual. First, Randy, since you're talking campaigns, you're the campaign vet, how are we going to change that?
Well, when I started Rainforest Action Network, we launched a 5-year national media campaign to popularize the rainforest issue. It wasn't number one on the global environmental issue back in the mid-1980s. And because we got out there and we sought every kind of free placement we could in any hippie vegetarian magazine or animal rights publication or whatever, and worked our way up to Time magazine, putting in full-page ads and buying full-page ads in the New York Times, public service announcements.
Celebrity endorsements.
Celebrity endorsements, all of that stuff. And we need that around ecologizing the economy and a new economic model. And we simply have to just get out there and do that. But part of what I'd like to see happen is that we build a new army around this. Pardon my military metaphor, but we need a grassroots army that writes letters to journalists, not so much op-eds or letters to the editor, but letters to actual journalists to get them to cover things like when they're failing to show the externalities in their news coverage. They're misleading the public. And we need the mass media to become the free press again and be a key feedback loop into the system. Every complex living system has feedback loops that allow it to be self-adjusting. We have, as a society, have not been getting sufficient feedback from mass media on how to adjust and correct and be sustainable in the long term. And so we need to educate the journalists, and so we need all of your listeners to be thinking as they read a story and they realize that the journalists didn't cover the externalities of, be it a coal-fired power plant or whatever, they write a letter to them, not lambasting them for not covering it properly, but inviting them to cover it properly.
And I must say that one of the things, I mean, it's interesting, as I'm listening to you, I hear two things. One is, you know, so we've got to revive the best of the mass media at a time when the mass media itself is struggling to survive. But the other point is that what does make what you're suggesting more possible than ever is you didn't used to see at the end of many, many newspaper articles the journalist's email address, and now very often you do. In other words, 10 years ago, it would have been hard to reach journalists. Now it's easier than it's ever been.
That's absolutely true, and the email and the internet gives us the capacity to do that. And I'm convinced that if journalists have this pointed out to them, that we'll start seeing a lot more and more in the coverage. And you know, when the Dow goes up, people will realize that's causing more damage to the earth. That's not a sustainable economy. We need that kind of feedback.
Okay. What is the status right now? Are you in the thinking stages, the alliance building stages? Where is this media campaign to take on our whole economic system?
We're in the alliance building and fundraising. I've started fundraising for it and lining up some money for 09 and 010 already for this campaign. The World Future Council has a project called Future Finance where they're looking, as David has done in his book, on what's the economic model for a deeply sustainable and more socially just society. We want the World Future Council, which is largely based in Europe, to be able to run an analogous campaign in Europe where they have a better chance of internalizing these pollution externalities, I think, more quickly than we'll be able to here in the United States. We're learning a lot from European policies these days. And we need to get them going on this new model as we do it here in North America. And between those two units, if we can get those two political units heading in a better direction, we'll be a more responsible part of the global family.
So if people want to learn more, get involved, Randy first, David next, what give us now, and listeners, get your keyboards out or your pens or papers out, and I will leave this information at the desk as well. The phone number at the station is 818-985-2711. You can also email me at temcnally@mac.com. But Randy, websites, organizations, if people want to get involved.
Well, the website for the World Future Council is simply worldfuturecouncil.org. And on that, you'll find the Future Finance Project.
Okay.
But people that really want to become part of this letter-writing army, they can email me directly at randy.hayes@worldfuturecouncil.org.
Okay. And David?
Yeah, well, I want to mention here that our current issue of Yes, it's just coming out from the printer, is on the new economy. And it provides a fabulous overview of the things that are doing and the issues we need to deal with, including a wonderful article by Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies that raised this very point you raised about Roosevelt and the.
Oh, excellent! And Yes Magazine online is
yesmagazine.org.
Okay, Yes Magazine, one word, .org.
And we have a major section on the website about these economic issues, and we're going to be continuously updating that. And of course, my own website, David Korten, davidkorten.org, will keep you in contact with all the stuff I'm doing, including one of the things I'm involved in is we call the New Economy Working Group, which is an alliance between the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, Yes Magazine, and the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And we're hoping to work with a wide swath of progressive organizations, much like what Randy's talking about, in helping them building an understanding of these larger systemic issues, the kinds of policies we need to change, and working together on the on the campaigns.
And the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, BALLE, what's their website?
Yeah, livingeconomies.org.
Yeah, see, that would not have been my first guess of what it would be, so that's good. I will, I said, I will leave this information at the desk here. The number that you'd call to find that information would be 818-985-2711. You can also email me at T.E. McNally@mac.com. You can email Randy at randy.hayes@worldfuturecouncil.org, and you can find David at davidcorton.org.
You know, before you go on, I want to just quickly jump in on your question of, you know, how do we overcome the resistance to change?
Yes, and you've got about a minute and a half to do that.
Okay, well, just quickly. The key here is that the world that we need to create in order to have a human future is the world, in fact, that most people want and that most people have wanted for millennia. And so it's not a hard sell if we can get the message out here that here is how we can actually have that world and how it will differ from the, you know, the pain and frustration and family breakdown and violence that we currently experience. So that to me is a very critical part of the message.
Is just to remind people and to invite people that this is actually what they truly want.
Exactly.
Okay. Again, David's book is Agenda for a New Economy. His website is David Corten. That's David, K-O-R-T-E-N, one word, dot O-R-G. Yes Magazine is at Yes Magazine, one word, dot O-R-G. Randy Hayes is with the worldfuturecouncil.org, and you can email him at randy.hayes@worldfuturecouncil.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly or get on my weekly announcement list telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background. And you do all that by emailing me at T.E. McNally, one word, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com.